This is Jane McGonigal, the author of Super Better and a big fan of the Psych Tech Podcast. You're listening to Psych Tech Podcast, where you will get the future of psychology and technology.
Hi, and welcome to Psych Tech, the Psychology and Technology Podcast, where we explore the human side of technology. Instead of a conversation between me and Kelly this week, we are going to post an interview from the Psychology of Everything podcast. Michael McClendon interviewed us for his show, and we talked about virtual reality. And we thought the interview came out pretty well. One warning on the audio, me and Kelly appear to be a lot louder than Michael. That was not my doing. I did not do that on purpose, so we would be louder. His sound is just a little lower, so just be careful if you're moving the volume up and down while you're listening to it. I think it's a pretty good conversation. Let us know what you think, and check out Michael's podcast. Again, that's The Psychology of Everything. Here's the interview.
Okay, so as always, we'll start with introductions. Kelly, yours is a little bit easier because you've been here before, but Josue, you're newbie, so maybe you can start off by introducing yourself.
All right. Thanks, Michael. My name is Josue Cardona. I am a licensed mental health counselor, and I do a lot of psychology and technology, geek culture, pop culture stuff. And actually relevant to this conversation, before becoming a clinician, I was a biomedical engineer. And I think that'll come up later in the conversation.
Oh, cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then Kelly, the lovely Kelly Dunlap, who's joining us again. For those who didn't hear the first episode with you, maybe a brief intro of yourself.
Sure. My name is Kelly Dunlap. I'm a doctor of clinical psychology, and I'm actually a fellow at American University in their Masters of Game Design program.
I was kind of curious. I didn't ask you before we started this, but, how's that going? 'Cause I don't think you had just started, but you were pretty new into it, I think, the last time we talked.
The last time we talked, I had just finished my first semester, and now I have one semester left to go.
Oh, wow. So how is it?
You think you'll make it, Kelly? You think you'll graduate?
I think I'm going to do it. I think I'm okay. I'm on track. Awesome. What happens afterwards, I don't know. I don't know how to job. So, you know, a doctorate followed by a master's, I you know.
Yeah, right.
I don't know anything else, guys.
Hey, but so what's the harder hurdle? Finishing up this master's or finishing up the doctorate?
Oh, the doctorate. Definitely a lot less fun. I mean, my homework for the last couple of weeks has been, I need to play video games. Oh darn. Yeah. That's it's a struggle. It is.
That's really rough. And so both of you have been GDCing and PAX Easting and doing presentations. Both of you had multiple presentations, I saw.
Well, we just got back from PAX, so that was March 22nd. I had a panel based on some game design-related research that I had done, and then Josue and I had a joint panel together that was based on the content that we do on our podcast, which is called Psych Tech.
Right.
And we did that at PAX, and really well attended, lots of really great questions from the audience, and as always, I love doing panels. They're so much fun.
And then, so did one of you go to GDC, or did both of you?
I went to GDC and I had a panel presentation with the cohort from the Game Lab at American. And it was specifically on, oh gosh, what was it called? Community engagement at the intersection of news and games. So the fellowship that I'm a part of is actually part of the journalism program, which is kind of an accident for me. That wasn't intentional, but it was mostly focusing on community engagement, community management. And my part focused a lot on engaging behaviors, troll behaviors, how to mitigate toxicity in communities.
Nice. Okay. So how was PAX? Here's what I'm curious about from both of your perspective. And I know that you talked about this on your show, but we'll hopefully invite crossover between our two shows. But for those who haven't listened to your show, I'm curious about, as two people in mental health, which I would guess would make you somewhat of a minority in terms of a participant at either of those conferences, what the experience was like being there.
So I think that psychology is a very popular word right now. It's a buzzword. People gravitate towards it. So my experience has been for the past few years and at different conferences, not just video game or technology related, but that like pop culture, things like that, that whenever you have psychology in the title, people just love it. They want to hear what you're going to talk about. So the panel that we did together and Kelly's other panel too, I mean, they were packed, you know, and people want to have conversations about serious issues related to things that they love.
Yeah.
And the rooms that we're talking about are about 300 to 400 headrooms.
That's awesome.
So people being turned away. I mean, it's always really not that people get turned away. That's not exciting. But that the people have a passion for it and they show up and they wait in line to hear about this kind of thing. At PAX in particular, you know, it's not just us having our psych panels. There's several other panels. There's always at least four or five that have the word psychology in them, whether it's how games help me cope with psychology from a gamer perspective, a non-clinical perspective, what Josue and I do, you know, more of a clinical perspective. And then there's also the AFK room, which is sponsored by Take This. Take This is a organization that's all about mental health in gaming. And they have a room that's kind of a quiet, safe space. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the convention or you're stressed out, it's a quiet place to go. You can charge your phone. Mm. There are licensed clinicians there as well as trained volunteers.
Oh, wow.
So if you need to talk something through, like there's somebody there for that. I know last year I was just kind of chatting with them and they said that they actually did have to have somebody referred out because he was the person was under so much stress that they needed to get him to a hospital. So I'm just so happy that they were there. They've been doing that for a couple of years now. I know last PAX East, so PAX East 2015, our buddy Steve Kuniak, who's also he just finished his PhD, but he's also a licensed counselor and he has the Geek and Gaming Counseling Alliance and they had a booth and he was doing his dissertation study there. And PAX has been really welcoming in that regard. So I don't necessarily feel like an outsider. I feel kind of like a superstar.
That's really
and
cool.
PAX, yeah, and PAX, they have PAX East, PAX Prime in Washington State, and PAX South in Texas. And I believe PAX East this year was their biggest ever out of the three.
Wow.
And but they have this partnership with Take This. So they have that AFK room at each of their conferences now. And I don't know if it's gone out to other conferences that the company does, but I still haven't seen something like that from other conventions, period. Like regardless of the subject matter. And I think it's really great to look at that and possibly emulate it in other places because those events can be really overwhelming.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, especially some of the bigger and the ones there's whatever it is that's in Germany is supposed to be just insane.
Gamescom.
Yeah.
Gamescom.
Yeah. I've heard reports that one is just so overwhelming in terms of people and everywhere, and even like just trash and the ripple effect of that many people in one spot, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So, what do you think? I mean, this is a bit of a tangent, but so how come PAX? Like, how come they are the ones that are kind of garnering this kind of goodwill towards acknowledging that there's a mental health component to the people involved with gaming?
Well, it doesn't. Personally, I don't think it has a very happy beginning. Mm. So there was quite a bit of controversy in the PAX community, specifically Penny Arcade, which is the original founders of the PAX Expo.
Okay.
And basically, they made light and made fun of rape survivors and engaging in rape culture. And to the point where their community actually turned on a lot of the women in the community and began harassing them. It was, if you look up a quote-unquote dick wolves, as professional sounding Dr. Kelly says, dick
wow.
wolves.
Awesome.
They even made t-shirts and sold t-shirts promoting this kind of mentality. Thankfully, most of the gamers involved in this had such strong backlash that Penny Arcade had to apologize. They had to recant. It's to the point now where they don't even call it the Penny Arcade Expo anymore. It's just PAX.
Wow.
They have intentionally tried to separate between the two because they had major developers refusing to work with them. They had large members of the community refusing to work with them because of their lack of humanity towards survivors of trauma.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and on Take This aside specifically, that organization was founded from by journalists within the video game industry. So the top people were all Polygon writers. And there was one video game journalist who committed suicide a couple of years ago, and he, like the all of his friends got together and created this organization to kind of, you know, bring light to the fact that there are issues in the video game industry at every level that people are not talking about. Hmm. And so they came together, they formed this organization, and since they had some sort of clout within the industry already, I'm assuming that's why they were able to, you know, speak to the right people and have that presence at events, you know, huge events like PAX.
Yeah.
And it even goes beyond PAX. At GDC, which is the Game Developers Conference, for those who might not be familiar, it's kind of like the APA of the games academic world. So it's the biggest academic research oriented game conference in the US, possibly the world. I'm not sure on that one. Mm. But Russ Pitts, who's one of the founders, and he is really big in the game community, was a member of a panelist of an entire workshop series at GDC on recognizing game developer stress, how to cope with game developer stress as a leader, what to do when you see game developer stress. And so they had this entire, I think it was four or five different workshops sequentially at GDC about, I mean, basically burnout and in the game developer space, specifically pertaining to mental health issues.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, because I wasn't aware that they had that. Obviously, I didn't attend GDC or anything, and I haven't seen the list of the presentations or anything. But I think that that's interesting, given that just in my own kind of, you know, on the fringe listening to games media types of things, I've heard more developers talking about this really intense cycle of trying to put games out, even when they're not, you know, a turn and burn operation in terms of putting out, you know, a game a year per se. But it's just such an intense trying to get everything done in such a short amount of time, and really with a lean and mean staff for a lot of games developers nowadays, now that the financial model is changing a bit, that it's interesting that they're at least acknowledging that this is affecting people's lives and their well-being in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, human beings have emotions.
Fancy
that. Who would
have thought? Sure. Yeah. Okay. So that's great. I didn't know any of that history. So thanks for sharing that. And I picked the right people to talk about this stuff with, I guess.
Gold star.
Gold stars for both of you. So I want to, let's transition and talk a little bit about, well, to the main topic, let's talk about virtual reality. And maybe to start, I am a complete noob. I have no experience whatsoever with virtual reality, but I know that both of you do. So who wants to share their experience, at least just kind of accounting of what they've experienced and maybe a little bit about what it's been like, and then we can go from there into thoughts about how this applies to psychology.
Well, I think one of the first things to consider is just even the basic history of virtual reality. It definitely seems to have just exploded in the last couple years or so, but there was a big virtual reality boom in the 80s.
Yeah.
And it was thought, you know, think about Tron era kind of perceptions. But the problem was that the technology at that point was just too expensive to have it be like a mass market. You know, to buy a VR device was, you know, even more expensive than a computer in that time, which at that time, only certain people could have computers, which is why home consoles became so big. So it's important to know that VR has a really long history. And I think you see that history in the mental health space as well as the entertainment space. As far as personal reflections, I think Josue probably has the most in-depth experience with VR so far.
Yeah, and you mentioned it was too expensive to buy a VR headset, but really, I don't think anybody was making them. They were being made in university laboratories and companies who were kind of exploring the technology. So now we can talk about it, and everybody, or a lot of people, know what it is. My experience is that people are still don't believe that it's a real thing, depending on who you talk to. But it's because now we're at there's a consumer level product and at varying prices too. So you can have something like Google Cardboard, which is actually a cardboard box where you put your phone in and you're able to have a VR light experience, all the way up to right now the most expensive consumer product is the HTC Vive, which costs about $800. So, and then you have products in between. And so now almost anybody can get into VR. And for example, the New York Times, they just announced that they're going to do a second round of a VR project that they're doing. So on Sunday newspapers, they're going to include Google's Cardboard viewer. So I think about 300,000 of them will go out to subscribers.
Wow.
And they have a story that they filmed in 360 video, which we can talk about like the difference between VR and a 360 video, and so that more people can experience it. And all you need is to put your phone in, and pretty much any phone will work. You put it into the cardboard and you can have that experience. So imagine where we're at, that even like you can get VR with your newspaper now.
Right. That's pretty wild. I remember, I mean, so to this point that it has such a long history, I remember in the mid 90s when Dave and Buster's as kind of took on this nationwide explosion and started popping up everywhere. I remember that they had kind of this, a singular or like one or two games that were VR light. I don't think that they were full VR, but you put on a headset and this type of thing. And they didn't last very long because people were getting sick and throwing up all over their game floors. I mean, I just remember it was in Atlanta. You know, I grew up in Georgia. I remember it was kind of this thing that was talked about. Like, one, it was super expensive. It was like $25 just for, a 20-minute experience or something like that. And then it was, there was someone, I remember seeing one, and it was like this thing in the center of their floor where there was an attendee always there, and they would pull you out after so long because otherwise the technology wasn't processing the visuals at fast enough frame rates that people weren't getting like motion sickness and things like this. So you could only be in it for a limited amount of time. At least that's what I recall from my young age. I mean, I was, preteen and teen at that point. So.
Yeah, and in the 90s, Nintendo released a console called the Virtual Boy.
Oh, right.
It looked like a virtual reality headset, and it was a complete failure.
Yeah.
for many reasons.
Yeah. Well, not the first, not the last by Nintendo mm-hmm. recently. So
well, you got to start somewhere, right?
That's true. But I think it's a really valid point, too, because there has been a lot of, the talk about, so one of the things that we'll get to is, is that I've seen is people talking a lot about exposure therapy and the application of VR to exposure therapy, which has been discussed and sometimes even, developed and played with in laboratories since the, 80s and 90s. It's just that now it's, like you said, the technology is advanced where you can afford a processor and it's compact, right? Like the computers in the 90s were enormous. And now, like the PlayStation, the addendum to the PlayStation 4 that you need for PlayStation's VR headset is smaller than a laptop. I mean, it's like the size of an iPad, in a sense. And so, and even the technology, I mean, you can get a computer that can do this stuff within about $1,000, which is a lot of money. But it, relatively speaking, is still way affordable for this type of tech.
Yeah. Plus,
especially considering the kind of the bleeding edge of VR has a lot of it has come from the military. Mm. The VA has used VR extensively, especially in their Honolulu location to do exposure therapy for PTSD. And they've been doing that for like over a decade. And so not only is it, something that's going to be more accessible to clinicians, it's something that existing clinicians who are familiar with how to use it now are going to have more opportunity to talk about it, be able to get it more places, and so that we can actually get some more research out of it. But the initial things are, hey, it works.
Right.
So that's good.
Yeah. When I was a biomedical engineer with the Army, and I've been to Tripler in Hawaii, and I was able to speak to a lot of people who, a lot of clinicians in the military who were doing this type of work. And it was so exciting. Like there was a lot of excitement around it because the possibilities of exposure therapy were
were just so great. And it really was like nothing you could do. There's just nothing close to it in the consumer world. It was one of those areas where they were really, really far ahead. And the equipment was very, very expensive and very experimental. But there was a lot of excitement there. And I think that same type of excitement I saw there, you know, just a few years ago, is now like the type of excitement that everybody has in terms of whether it's education or medicine or, you know, psychology or even, you know, tourism and social media, all of these things. It's great to see that everybody is kind of on the same, excitement level and, you know, speculating and wanting to try stuff out.
Yeah, right. So I'm curious, both of you have tried it at different products, but both of you have at least tried these modern versions. I'm curious from a personal level, and this is a bit putting you on the spot. So if you need to come back to this or don't have clear thoughts, sure. But I'm curious just from your perspective, what the experience was like and what you noticed in terms of just being in it and using it and different things that stand out to you in that regard.
Awesome. I think that is a pretty good summary of the experiences that I've had. So I've used Google Cardboard, which again is the small cardboard box that you drop your smartphone into. And that was novel. It was interesting. It was kind of fun to play with, but definitely still felt kind of gimmicky. Mm-hmm. Whereas at GDC, I had the opportunity to try out the Samsung Gear. And again, that's a full headset, goes over your eyes, has full surround sound. So you're wearing headsets as well. And I played a bunch of different games. And they all had, I think, a really different effect on how I experienced them. So one was a game in space where I was shooting down aliens and I was targeting them with my eyes and then tapping the side of the headset to fire. Oh, wow. So that was a very action-oriented thing that was a lot of fun. There was a puzzle game where I moved the puzzle pieces based on eye tracking. So I kind of felt a bit like a telepath. And it was very serene. It was very calming. It was almost meditative, but of course it was designed that way intentionally. I tried a horror game for about 2 seconds and then nope. Not happening. And let's see, there's another one. It's an escape room. So if you're familiar with that in the physical world, you know, you're locked in a space and you have to solve a bunch of codes and problems and locks to escape the room. And that was kind of fun to move around with my eyes and, you know, find a code and go over to the clock and change the clock. I didn't get out in time because my time with the headset got cut short. But so each of those, and this is just all on one console, so to speak, they all had very different feelings and experiences and levels of engagement for me.
How about for you, Josue?
So it depends a lot on the software, right? On what you're running. Virtual reality is really more of a medium than it is like just one experience.
Sure.
I went to it was called the Tribeca Film Institute's interactive conference. And a lot of the talk was about VR and how people are making movies in VR, you know, and there's different levels to that. There's the 360 video. Like right now you can go to YouTube and search for 360 videos, and you can watch a YouTube video where you can click on the screen and drag it and look wherever you want.
Right.
And now, you know, like GoPro has released a module where you can put a bunch of GoPros together and film your own, and you can buy VR or 360 video cameras. And so that's one way to do it. And then you can, for example, you could live stream that. So it's not necessarily an edited experience. You could just be somewhere else and look around. Right. So, and the quality of that depends a lot on the equipment that you're using. So Google Cardboard is your cell phone, your smartphone, slip it in, and then you hold it with your hand. It's kind of like, even ViewMaster is actually a Google Cardboard now. If you buy the new ViewMaster, you put your phone in and you kind of move it around with your, you know, you move your head and your hands together. The Samsung Gear VR is, it also uses your cell phone, but it's a full-blown headset. So you put the cell phone in, but you strap it on. And so it's a little more immersive. Okay. And then beyond that, you can do something like the PlayStation VR, which will be compatible with a PlayStation console. It's more expensive than the Gear VR, but it's a full-blown headset. you use controllers, then you've got your Oculus and your, which is a very good headset. And then all the way up to the Vive, which has sensors in the room and can, you can use a 10 by 10 space to actually move around. It'll track your movement. So something built specifically for the Vive can, could be an interactive experience where you're actually walking around.
Right.
Right. Inside a space, and it'll reset depending on where you are, versus something like the PlayStation VR might be more, you know, it can track your head movement and your hands, but it couldn't track you, you know, 10 feet away, for right. example. That's not built for that. So it depends a lot on the format of the software that you're using or the experience. So an interactive movie, for example, can be, is very different from a full blown video game.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And like you're saying, the 360 video, I mean, so I, some of the applications that I've heard from that are like concerts or being, you know, geographical locations like National Geographic, taking 360 images of, you know, Machu Picchu or something like this. And so this kind of virtual tourism in a sense where you don't necessarily get to walk around or you're on a guided walking around versus a more immersive, like I'm in a world that's built. That, no, you know, like if I'm in this room, it, it orients to the room and will make sure that I turn before I walk into a wall or something like this. And so it, it, you know, it's a more immersive type of experience. Yeah. Which is, I think what you're saying, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And even something like, one thing I saw recently at the Tribeca Interactive was the, there was an experience where you put on the headset and then you're seeing a an act of police brutality. And so it's very different from just seeing it on a TV screen where you can look away and you still see your room. Now you're looking inside and you're on the street. You're seeing it. You're seeing this thing happen. And all of a sudden, the police officer sees you and walks towards you. And, you know, it's like it's talking to you. You're looking straight at the person and they ask you a question and then you see options. And the experience of when you look around to see if any, you know, who's he talking to? You know, it's you because you're in that world. That person is standing right in front of you. It's very different than if you were seeing that on a TV screen. And, you know, there's that, not that disconnect.
Yeah, this was actually an interesting application. Oh, go ahead, Kelly. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just to kind of to drive home that idea a little bit further, PAX East 2015, there was a game where it simulated the Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. So like a 360-degree view of the Grand Canyon. And people were standing there looking around the Grand Canyon and they were told to jump off the Grand Canyon.
Oh, wow.
Now they know that they are in PAX East. They know that there is solid ground beneath their feet, but I don't think anybody was able to do it.
Yeah.
They were not able to override their primal brain instincts of you cannot fly. Do not jump off the Grand Canyon.
Right.
And so again, even though your logical processing centers, so again, in this, you know that that police officer can't hurt you. And logically, you know this because you know that you are in this experience. But because there's so many sensory inputs telling you, the most important ones being sight and sound, telling you that this is a real thing, it just, it completely overrides your reason to not be afraid. And so I think in that way, it can be really powerful when doing things like, say, exposure therapy, because it's, you're kind of hijacking your brain, but hopefully for good.
One of my first experiences was in a very simple looking two-story house. And I was on the second floor on a balcony and I wanted to look at the first floor from up there. So there was a railing and I reached out to grab the railing to support myself, but there was no railing.
Right.
And I almost fell on the show floor.
Yeah, no, I've heard of a similar thing where there was a, so are you familiar with the movie Man on a Wire and the documentary? I think of the
yeah,
same name.
Yeah, made a whole experience for the new movie. Yeah.
Yes. So they made an experience where, so I heard on a podcast, there it was someone talking about a closed door demo of this for developers. I think it might've been a GDC. And they laid down a cable on the ground. It wasn't the actual dimensions of the cable that was used, but it was just a cable that represented it. And then they had people put the headset on and it transported them into this experience of walking across this cable between the two towers. And supposedly like
people freaked out.
Yeah. Like nobody made it right. Like, and people kept like, or like they ran across if they did make it. Yeah. I mean, so, which is interesting because this is one of the things that I think is just as a, you know, as, you know, the next call of technology and us interacting with it, I think that there's going to be some, I mean, these are anxiety provoking experiences in a lot of ways that we know. I mean, it's almost like vivid dreaming, except in a very different sense is the closest application that I have for it. And this idea, like what you said, Kelly, of the horror game genre. I know that there's a lot of people that love to be scared, but there's a part of me that's worried about the psychological effects in some ways. And I don't want to be a harbinger of, oh, doom and gloom, new technology, but more so like, these are really things for us to think about in a sense. Cause there's some really creepy games out there. I mean, for me, you know, I love the Zelda franchise, but the moment that they put me in a room with a giant tarantula, I'm going to throw a headset down on the ground and smash it with a bat because I'm not going to be, I'll have to go through the exposure therapy first for the spiders before I can play the game. So, you know, this is one of the things that I think is interesting is just thinking about that this is a whole new level of thrill in a sense for us in terms of a medium that I don't think that we've encountered yet.
I mean, it's technology. It's always the new frontier. You know, at some point, the printing press was magic.
Yes.
You know, the radio was a magic box, too. And I think what you pointed out really well, Michael, though, is that people get to pick. It's not like this is a forced reality on us. And I will not play I don't play horror games on my Xbox One. I don't enjoy them. I don't enjoy horror films. I don't need something to make me afraid. Like, that's just not something that I seek out. And that's okay, because there are some people that are those thrill seekers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would imagine playing a VR video game that's terrifying or thrill inducing. Maybe you wouldn't jump out of an actual airplane anymore, because that to me is something I would never do. Again, that's a thrill seeking adrenaline junkie kind of, enjoying that feeling of fear. And so I'm not worried, just because once again, the video game industry, the entertainment industry as a whole, is very well regulated in terms of letting you know the content. Mm-hmm. So the game I played was Goosebumps, after the old R.L. Stein children's novels, right, which I read and I thoroughly enjoyed. But I knew, I'm like, as soon as I turn my head, there's going to be something there. I know it. Like, all the cues are there. If I just close my eyes, like being a little kid, like pulling the blanket over your head.
Yeah.
So that's not going to be my genre, and that's okay. And so I guess that's where I'm not personally worried about it, because for me, I'm not going to play it. People who don't enjoy that kind of sensation aren't going to play it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with children or whatever, I wouldn't let them play a horror game until it was developmentally appropriate anyway.
Sure. Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, there's games that I thoroughly love that have a bit of suspense to them. You know, I mean, I think of something that's even relatively mild, like Firewatch, which I'll admit I haven't played, but I've already spoiled it for myself by listening to reviews and things. So it's not something I would have played anyway.
Don't spoil it. I'm halfway through.
I won't. I'm not going to spoil it. But there's suspenseful elements of that I think, as soon as you put yourself into a situation where you've blocked out. You know, because if we're in a movie and it gets a little suspenseful or frightening, I can look at a wall and be like, okay, I'm in a movie theater, right? But if I'm in a virtual reality headset, I turn and I'm still in the same place. So there's, you know, of course you take the headset off, but it's a less grounded experience, at least from someone who's never, I mean, this is kind of, so me playing devil's advocate a little bit. And again, I don't want to be, I'm certainly not on this bandwagon of we need to be worried about VR. I'm just thinking about it from a perspective of this really strong disconnect is interesting, from a perspective of what is that going to be like on a daily basis when these things are more common?
So I'll argue that a scary VR game has the potential to be better than a non-VR version if what you're looking for is the scare factor.
That's true. Yeah, for sure.
You know, it's like how many times have you gone to a theater and it's like, you know, it's creepy, but it's not super scary because the person next to you is like eating popcorn or the kid behind you is like kicking a chair or something like that, right? And they kind of like, they ruin the movie for you.
Yeah.
And so it could be, if your goal is to get scared, and there's that. And, you know, on the jumping out of an airplane scenario, I am terrified of that, but I would love to do a VR simulation of that because it removes the actual, you know, risk, right? Like I'm aware of the actual risk and it removes that, but I'll be able to have that experience. Some of the scariest moments of my life were on roller coasters where for a moment I thought I was going to fall out and I thought I was going to die. But, and, you know, and even though I know that thing is strapped in, I know, you know, it's, I'm going to be okay. For a moment, I forget that. And afterwards, I'm like, man, that was kind of cool. But it was, I was still like really high up in the air and going very, very fast. And if there's a safer way to approximate that, I think, at least I'm interested in that. But it all depends on what you're looking for. First person shooters, I can't turn around. And if there's something right at me, like I'll jump out of my seat. Like I am, even like on just a regular like Call of Duty game, I can't. I'm very jumpy.
You get a pretty high startle response, huh?
yeah. It's pretty bad. So for me, I don't know, you know, how I'll be. I'll probably just be more careful in a VR game. You know,
creeping around the corner. Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. So I think it depends on what you're looking for, and then the potential. The goal of storytelling and video games has always been to engross the audience, to make it more immersive for the player. And this technology, if used correctly, can do that to levels that it wasn't possible to before.
Yeah, I totally agree with that for sure. And I completely agree with the idea that, you know, I mean, I love roller coasters. And at the same time, there are these moments when it's like, well, stranger things have happened. That wheel could come loose. And this thing could go plummeting. Like there is a physical risk. It's been mitigated by safety precautions, but nothing's for certain, right? And so there is this kind of reducing that physical risk that you're taking in a given situation. But at the same time, there's one of the reasons I think, given I've never experienced this, but one of the things that I think contributes to why it's so effective is because we know that there is no mind-body split. It's mind-body. And so our body still responds with the same physiological responses during imagined or perceived experiences, even though they may not be real. So the virtual reality environment can still create that thrill without actually putting your physiology in danger of, you know, a parachute not opening, in a sense.
And I think that's the real strength of VR, both as an entertainment tool and as a clinical tool. Mm. So as an entertainment tool, there was a game I played called Time Machine, and you're positioned in a chair, and you're in real life, you're sitting. So that's good. You want your VR experience and your physical experience to match up as closely as you can. That really helps reduce, you know, sickness and vomiting and fun stuff like that.
Right.
And so I'm like scooting along. I have a little hover chair, and I go to like the top of the level, and the guy taps me on the shoulder and he says, look down. And so I look down towards where my feet should be, but instead there's this giant sprawling canyon.
Wow.
And I feel my stomach just drop to my intestines. And there's this moment of my breath catching in my throat. And it was a really amazing experience, you know, whatever you want to think about it. So as entertainment, I thought that was really cool. As far as clinically working at it, we've mentioned a lot of times that it mitigates the risk. And that's always one of the most difficult things about exposure therapy in general, is that if your fear is, I don't know, heights or something, the fact that you actually have to go up the stairs, or if you're afraid of a certain kind of animal, you have to get in contact, and animals can be unpredictable. Or, you know, if you were in a car accident and now you're afraid of cars, at least to me, that there's this really important point where exposure therapy might become more effective, or at least more approachable, because a lot of people will refuse exposure therapy because you have to confront what you fear. And if you fear something, it's probably because there is some kind of risk either to you emotionally or physically. Whereas in a virtual space, I guess you could argue the damage emotionally could still be there if you've got zombies popping out of walls, but physical things like heights or gunshots or war simulations, that kind of thing, I think people might be more willing. And so I'm hoping that it'll continue to have some really good results, not just because it's effective and you can simulate something. Like, it's unethical for some reason to send somebody back into a war zone, I figure. So not only is it safer, but I think it might help people who would really benefit from exposure, but are either too anxious to engage with it, especially with this entire generation of OEF, OIF veterans who pretty much grew up on video games. And so saying, hey, this is a VR experience for your treatment, I can imagine that improving treatments across the board.
Well, and for me and for me and Kelly, for example, who are learning game design and app development, and we're learning to code and manipulate and create experiences like this, we could create, I mean, we can fine tune those exposure experiences. Mm-hmm. We can add more elements. We can reduce the variables. We can make it slightly more comfortable, or we can, you know, we can fine tune the experience in a way that you can't possibly do in real life.
Yeah.
I can put Josue on a roller coaster that just goes down, down, down and never stops.
She could.
The infinite loop of terror. I think, so, yeah, right. The thing that stands out for me is specific phobias for various mm-hmm. animals and such. And then also like, you know, like for years, there's been the flight phobias, of the fear of flying, and they will, they're the, you know, short regional flights that they set up to take, you know, several, if not a full flight of people flying. And it's not that you can get away with not doing that physical experience, but this is yet another gap filler between the therapy office, or the laboratory and the real life experience. It's more analogous. And so that transition to the real is far less a jump at the end.
Yeah, I would
of the
agree.
You know, so, you know, but this is, so what's interesting to me is that from a therapy perspective, from a clinical perspective, what I find to be somewhat even more intriguing is augmented reality. So like the HoloLens that Microsoft is developing, because, you know, one of the things that I imagine, so I hate tarantulas, I hate spiders. And my son, who now loves spiders, is really forcing me to do my own exposure therapy on this that I've avoided for years, which is great. Let me tell you, the zoo is a really fun trip now. And so one of the things that I could imagine is that being in this, like putting one of these headsets on with headphones and being so immersed and separated from my real world and feeling controlled in that way with such a thing that promotes such anxiety would in some ways be a hard sell for me, mm-hmm. because I'm having to put a lot of trust into somebody. And so if I think about PTSD types of things and the symptomology and the understanding of what it's like to be in a PTSD type of thing, trust is a big issue. So to trust someone that has control over that you don't in a lot of ways, like they're going to control what comes on the screen, would be hard. But with the something like the HoloLens, where it's just an overlay, and so you're not separated from where you are in the office per se or where you are in reality, it just overlays on top of it. So it feels like an easier transition in that regard. I don't know what y'all's thoughts are on that.
I think as Sifway mentioned, you know, the fact that at least in virtual reality and augmented reality as well, you get to control everything. So if I was to design a virtual experience for you, you know, the first step might be, okay, you're going to go to the zoo virtually, and then you're going to go through the invertebrate house virtually. You know, I would not put you in a battle against Shelob as your first, you know, foray into virtual reality of spiders. So that
right,
said,
sure.
I think, yeah, but augmented reality definitely has its benefits as well, because as you mentioned, you are still somewhat grounded because the world around you is still the world around you. There's just extra information added onto it. And I honestly think it's going to end up being a preference. I mean, because some people can't do VR. They yeah. can't handle this motion sickness that comes with it. So augmented reality might be a better situation. On the other hand, I feel like virtual reality is more immersive, so you might get more salient results.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to tell. We should do a study.
It would be. It'd be a very interesting study to see, to set up some of these trials with these things, I think.
Get at us, NIH. No.
That's right.
And the possible disconnect for AR, because it's a lot harder to make something seem real if it's overlaid onto something that is real than it is to just completely take over all of your senses in VR. So again, yeah, the immersion factor. And augmented reality, the appeal there goes beyond beyond just that overlay. It's actually the physical experience, the physical interaction. So for example, if you, the maximum potential of something, I'm sorry, wait a minute.
There's like, Josue, are you on fire?
Yeah. I was like, can they hear this? I was like, yeah, they can probably hear this.
Is it hot in here? Or is it just Josue?
That's right.
Did I mention Brooklyn busy street building? Okay. So the potential really comes from mapping over the things that are really in the environment.
Right.
So if you have a table, it doesn't look like a table anymore. Right. So for example, something like if fear of spiders, maybe if we had a little device that you could have on your leg or put on your arm that simulated the feeling or the movement of a spider, and then the augmented reality gives an overlay of a spider. So we have a controlled experience for you where you're actually feeling it and it looks to you like it's a spider. Like that's where the potential is really for augmented reality versus using the same device in virtual reality and you can't actually see it's not your arm. We can make your arm blue or purple or, the proportions wouldn't be the same. So it might not be as effective in that environment as it would be in augmented reality.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've even heard discussions from some, from the game side, talking about that you have to, one of the things that complicates development for games for VR is that, if you make someone, if someone identifies as male and then all of a sudden is playing a female character, that is a separation in terms of the immersion. So I think what you're saying, it's again, in terms of a clinical application, there's going to be a gap between, clinical applications are not going to be as nice as the most recent Call of Duty because they just don't have as much money to do these types of developments. And the better programmers are going to be in the games world, not necessarily in the clinical world. And so you're going to have less realized, reality per se, in terms of a one-to-one exact replication of someone in that world. Until we have cameras that are, able to, do that.
Yeah. And I found that is slowly moving. Mm-hmm. When people are asking for grants for studies like this, they need to start asking for a little extra money for that actual part to make it. And I've heard of some instances where it's happening. It's like, hey, we can actually hire a developer to make something good instead of,
let's piece something together.
cobble
it together the best we can. And basically find a student on the university where it's being developed and bribe them into doing it for free, in a sense.
Yeah.
Hey, undergrad, do you want extra credit?
That's right. Exactly. So, okay. So one of the things that I thought about, and Josue, you brought this up with the experience that you were talking about at the Tribeca, the conference that you were at, the Tribeca conference one of the classes that I teach at the University, actually the only class I teach at the University of Tulsa, is the psychology of diversity. And one of the things that I try to have students do is an immersion experience that pushes them in ways that feel very uncomfortable for them in terms of how they identify. And so I think that there's a real, a very useful, this provides a very useful tool in this regard in terms of experiencing, racial violence or any kind of marginalized group or, like being able to spend 3 hours in the life of someone who is homeless and what that experience is like for them on the streets or things like this to really garner and engender the empathy that we're looking for,
Yeah. Even just traveling to places that you've never seen, that can be such a transformative experience.
Right.
To go somewhere and see where people come from. But yeah, there are a few, I can't remember any specific names or where I saw it, but there are more experiences like that where you can share these experiences that you would know, there's no way you would ever, you could read about them, maybe you could see a documentary, but it's very different when the camera is positioned at the height of a child in that experience. And you're looking around and there are other people there who like you're sharing that experience with them. And people are doing that. There are, I think, Charity Water, Tom's Shoes. These are companies with a very social mission for their products. And or in case of Charity Water, like there isn't really a product there. It's a service that they're providing, and they have these virtual reality experiences for that purpose. You know, because they want people to understand something that, in a way that it wasn't possible to understand it before. Yeah, lots of potential.
Even beyond empathy building, it's this kind of situation is being used for teaching. So, for example, I think it was last year. Yeah, February of last year, I was actually interviewed by Newsweek. There's a psychologist who made a virtual reality game that was used as a training tool to help women say no to men at bars. So the idea was that it was an anti-sexual harassment training type of situation. So, you know, you're actually, you know, quote unquote, face to face with a virtual reality male avatar, and he's making a pass, or, you know, however you want to define it. And the idea is that, again, we're creating a safe space, or rather it is a safe space where we're being allowed to explore, and in this case, practice the kind of behaviors that we would want to exhibit in a physical space. So it's like role play on steroids, yeah, I guess, sure, is the best way of describing it, is that they, you know, women who a lot of times have been socially trained to smile and nod at advances, even though they don't want them, in this case, we're actually able to practice assertiveness and different strategies for saying no and things like that. So the study used it only on women as a training program. And one of my critiques of that particular study was that, well, what about getting men to do it can feel what it feels like? So I think both the empathic understanding and then the actual like application of practical skills, whether it's augmented reality or virtual reality, I'm really excited to see what that's going to look like in the future once psychology decides that, hey, this is a really cool thing and maybe we should really put money behind it.
Yeah, so in the year 2100, when APA
finally... we move slow. Because it's true.
but I think that's really an application I hadn't even thought about, Kelly, but role play is such an integral part of therapy in a lot of ways, especially so I think about anger management types of things or substance abuse treatment
psychodramas
where you're acting things out. There's even, nightmare treatments that have you, try to change or talk about the outcome or change the outcome or these types of things. Even self-injury. And suicide. I mean, I was thinking about, like, I wonder if there's a way to, and this is a little dicey. You got to be careful how you do this, and it definitely needs to be something that's well done. But somebody who tends to end up with, that kind of leans towards acting out in suicidal ways during distress, and they have a hard time tolerating distress. To have them be able to go through and make different choices or see choices play out in ways with frightening detail, and I, again, that's where you have to do some studies to find out, like, are we causing more harm than good? But I think that there is some room to play with that clinically in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. And there's a lot of opportunity to make it culturally appropriate. Absolutely, take that into consideration. Mm-hmm. Again, if we're talking about, like, to take the harassment experience, if it's live action, we could film 3 or 4 different men, right? And kind of switch them out interchangeably or if it's completely digital, then we could, we could move a slider and change the skin color or change what the voice sounds like. And we could modify all these different factors for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
It is almost literally the click of a button would give you the ability to adapt the situation to different cultural like Josue said, like a slider, changing the skin color or, adjusting the gender or the weight.
Wow.
I mean, because I know a lot of times with role plays, people get weirded out. Like, hey, pretend I'm your boss. No, I really don't. I'm your mom. No, you're not. Imagine an augmented reality overlay where they can put a picture of their mom or you know, move my eyes and my skin tone around to where I actually look more like their mom. That would be so cool.
Well, that would, I mean, that really changes.
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, that's the, so Freud's famous quote about that you can't slay dragons in absentia, right? Like all of a sudden now we can slay dragons because, yeah. You know, these metaphorical things like the person who abused me or the person who, like, if it was my dad or if it was my mom, I mean, again, you have to program these things in. So there's that technical issue, but we are
the empty chair doesn't have to be empty anymore.
Right. Like we are very close to that in a lot of ways. I mean, in some respects, this brings up the telemedicine things that are going on right now and the use of things like what we're using to record this, you know, the Google Hangouts or the Skype calls that are used for therapy. Well, now augmented reality, your therapist is in the room with you and your client's in the room with you. I mean, there was actually, I saw something where this technology is also pushing holographic imagery. In a lot of different ways and creating, making it more plausible and realistic in a lot of different ways in that regard, which, you know, for rural areas in terms of clinical need and clinical resources, I mean, speaking from the state of Oklahoma, which we count the licenses are here for licensure are counted in sequential order. And in 2014, when I got licensed in the state of Oklahoma, my license number was 1203. So that means that there's only been 1,202 people before me since they started doing licenses in the state of Oklahoma that have been licensed psychologists. I mean, that speaks to just how few people we have in the state and we have more than, you know, Montana, there's people out there that really need to be able to access healthcare in that way.
I'm still hung up on the idea that I could change my credentials on my business card from psychologist to dragon slayer.
That just blew your mind. It just opened up a world of possibilities.
Yeah. That's going to happen. That's going to have to happen at some point. Huh. How do I make that happen? Sorry.
Hi, everybody. You know how I hate to cut out these edits. I like to keep the interviews fully intact, but Kelly's feed dropped out just due to a technical issue. This is what happens when you're using Skype and Google Chats and these types of things. They happen on occasion. So we cut this piece out. I'm going to pull us back in after the break that we took for that. And this is just me explaining what that this little junction is. Okay, back to the interview. Okay, so that was just a weird little technical thing, and obviously there's going to be like a blop. But Kelly, you were talking about rural healthcare.
Right. So we're talking about, you know, telehealth and having, you know, beaming your psychiatrist or your counselor metaphysically into your office and or into your home. And I just remember as someone studying for licensure, there's an entire section of the APA ethics code about serving underserved populations and, you know, what do you do if you're the only psychologist for 200 miles and, you know, your best friend needs a therapist? And just the idea that these kinds of ethical issues could just be dealt with so easily is really exciting.
Yeah. So I'm going to switch us into a topic that we haven't talked about, but is the most obvious thing to talk about. And probably what everybody listening is thinking, also sex, because one of the biggest applications of VR is going to be the porn industry, which often drives this kind of interactive type of thing. So, but also just in terms of relationships and human sexuality, and, you know, human sexuality has gotten different with the access of the internet, and you know, people are finding ways anonymously to experiment with their sexuality. And also people are finding it that they can connect with other like-minded people in terms of their sexual interest, which isn't, I mean, again, speaking to the rural areas, that may not always be the case in a small town in the middle of Nebraska. Right. So, or a safe thing in these small towns. And so I think too, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about in terms of healthcare and psychology, that there's definitely going to be application and effect here with virtual reality and augmented reality.
And there already are. Like the porn industry, bless their hearts, are very technologically forward. No, seriously, they are some of the most innovative. They were the first ones to get on webcams. They were really the first ones to launch VHS and DVD. Hey, props off to the porn industry, okay? I appreciate your forward thinking in the technology space.
I'm pretty sure that the Blu-ray, there was something, whether it was Blu-ray or it was streaming video, but there was something, and I read an article or heard a piece that was talking about that essentially that technology was completely driven by pornography and the prolific nature of pornography.
I believe you're talking about the HD DVD Blu-ray battle of a few years ago.
Yes. That's what it was. Right.
I backed HD DVD, porn backed Blu-ray, and I lost.
Yeah. You weren't the only one.
Good to know. I mean, as far as sexuality, I mean, to me, it's very much one of those things that's along the same lines as horror games or adventure games or anything else, that there's going to be an audience for it. And it's going to be important to try and make sure that it's as safe as possible. And there's going to, again, as long as there's a demand for it, people are going to make it. So the idea of, I'm not saying don't worry about it, because that's probably a little bit too extreme, but I'm hopeful that maybe this will spark human conversations about sex.
Yeah.
Because that tends to be something we as a society are really terrible about.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons that porn is so prominent and so much part of our culture, is we've shamed sex to the point where we have to have almost an underground industry to service those kinds of very basic, normal human desires. And I'm not saying like the extreme stuff is, I'm trying to be very careful here. You know, obviously there is some stuff that goes on in porn that is not, I'm going to say, a normal human desire, like snuff films and things like that.
Or that's not even healthy. But I mean, that's everything. That's right. Going to the movie theater, right?
But yeah, just the idea that, you know, if we didn't shame sex so much, maybe people wouldn't feel the need to hide that they like sex or that they want sex or they want a particular kind of sex.
Right.
So the same way that the internet opened up people to connect with others who had similar sexual interests or academic interests, I think VR is going to be another way for people to, you know, exchange sexual interests. And I'm actually really interested to see how that affects like sex workers and say the prostitution industry and things like that. And I think it would be great if all of our sex workers were safe because it was done digitally instead of, risking their own health.
Yeah. I mean, I actually have an optimistic viewpoint on this. I think that, from both a perspective on sex therapy, and there's, you know, this kind of gray area of sex surrogate therapy, which I'm not schooled in and I don't know enough about, so I'm not going to speak on, but I know it exists. Right. And then there's this, you know, the idea, I've worked with a lot of different people who, because of social anxiety, have never had the sexual experiences and the sexual gratification that they've wanted. And not to say that an augmented reality type of device or a virtual reality device would gratify those needs completely, but it would do a much more substantive shade better than what they have at the moment, to make that experience for them a lot better, and make it feel less desperate and make it feel less stressful and less draining of other areas of their life, you know?
So in VR and porn, there's a lot of things going on. Like, there's a large spectrum. One is it's going to be very popular just because of like the nature of the fact that probably the type of media where people want to move the camera to a specific area the most is when watching porn, right? Or focus one thing. And now you have that control, right, with a 360 camera and video. As far as the interactive component, we actually did an episode where we talked about some of the things that exist for like remote sex toys, you know, another person can control what you're doing. So then the having a 360 camera on both sides has an extra element of that. I think we're really, really far from something like, I don't know if you remember the scene in Demolition Man where supposedly it's an old Sylvester Stallone and Wesley Snipes movie. And in the future, right, nobody has sex anymore.
They put on the headsets.
It's not allowed. Yeah, it's not allowed. So you have to put on these headsets and you have this experience, and because they say that it's safer.
Right.
And it's I forget if they describe it as just, it's just like dirty or unsanitary, I think is what
they sterilize it through these headsets. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we're really, really far away from approximating that, because just like we talked about the fear component and the risk component of, like, I don't want to jump out of a plane because I'm weighing that risk versus that experience. Right. And so the same thing will happen here, and we'll have to see how good the tech gets to approximating the real thing for something like to happen. But I think that there will be new versions that we haven't thought of yet for using this technology.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that, you know, there's, like you said, there's been devices. I mean, there's remote devices that have been designed for couples who are separated by distance, that help engage, you know, that bridge the divide. I think that this is another addition to that in a lot of ways. And, you know, I mean, there was even a spoofed version of some of these devices, kind of a comical one that was done on an episode of The Big Bang Theory, where there was like this kissing machine that you could feel the other person kissing you back. And it was, you know, transmitted via the internet and the interwebs. And, you know, they make fun of it in this comical experience of two of the characters, both male, that have this very homoerotic subtext, like making out with separate dolls with each other. And these things, they already are in existence. And again, it's very similar to what we were talking about with therapy. It's just another piece that's going to bridge the distance between this and the real thing, in ways that it'll have the bad half. It'll have the bad seedy part of it, just like everything else in life. But I think I really present it as an idea that I think that there's a lot of potential here in good, in doing good in a lot of people's lives.
Going back to the idea of,
go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I mean, just the last, just going back to the idea of role-playing again. I mean, it's one thing for me to sit with a client and say, okay, role play that I am your really horrible boss. Role play that I am your overprotective mother. I don't have any experience, and I'm pretty sure I would not feel comfortable saying, and it probably would not even be ethical. In fact, I'm certain it would not be ethical to say, role play that I am your lover, so that we can see what happens with, you know. And so, yeah, it could be used as a very useful tool in addressing issues that are often seen as taboo, and therapists in particular have very limited ability to address compared to some other things like exposure therapy or things like that, you know, role playing your boss versus your lover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
And to a lesser degree, things like body dysmorphia and body issues and things like that. There's also a lot of potential there.
Oh, that's a really interesting idea with the body dysmorphia, for sure. I mean, because then, you know, then even with the technology of the sliders, you know, the therapist being able to witness what they're seeing could have the, you know, they could make the change in that experience while they're in there in certain ways. That's a really powerful idea. I hadn't even considered this way. So, well, so we're not going to cover the whole thing, but I think we've done a pretty good job. And this was really the conversation that I was hoping to have. So thanks for both of you. I don't know if there's any final thoughts that the two of you have. We're almost at an hour's time, so I don't want to keep us too long, and I don't want to eat up any more of your time on this weekend. But I want to give, if there's any other thoughts that we haven't covered that you wanted to kind of throw in there. Or...
Yeah, I would say definitely go and check out 360 videos on YouTube to get that first idea of kind of what we're talking about, because it's really hard to understand without at least seeing a part of it. You can do it on your phone, and that way you just move your phone around and you can kind of get that idea of having a window into another space. Augmented reality is even more difficult to understand. So a game like Ingress, where it has GPS coordinates where things are happening and then you can only see it on your phone, or something like Yelp's Monocle, which will put an overlay of restaurant reviews and ratings over the actual view of the things, of the restaurants that you're looking at in a real space through your phone screen. Like those are small windows into the technology that we're talking about. And if you get a chance, go to, you know, keep an eye out on, like, you know, big retailers like Best Buy or GameStop when they'll have equipment there for you to try out. And or just, you know, spend $15 on buying a Google Cardboard to kind of get that first taste of what it's like. If you have a smartphone, then you're set to start seeing what's out there.
And just to echo what Hostway said, I guess the number one thing that's most important to me is that clinicians go out and try it and get a taste of it, because it's coming. It's like winter. It is coming, and there's no stopping it. And very, very similar with video games. You doesn't really matter how you feel about them as far as kids playing them or adults playing them.
They're here.
The fact that 99% of teenagers play video games, over half the US population plays video games, pretending that it's a thing that doesn't exist or willing it to not exist is not going to be helpful to you or your clients.
Yeah.
So no matter how you feel about VR, at least go out. And it's kind of like cultural competence. You just you have to educate yourself in the culture of technology to be able to connect effectively with anybody.
Yeah, for sure. You cut out there at the end, but I really like the idea of a call to, I think that it's our job as clinicians to be aware. Technology is not going away. Technology is a thing. It affects us. It affects psychology broadly and individually, and making yourself aware of it is really important in a lot of different aspects. Not to say that you have to like it or agree with it or be consumers of it yourself, but you should at least have some awareness of it if it enters your office, and it will. And if you're not allowing for it to enter your office, then you're shutting out a part of someone else's experience that may be very, very, very clinically relevant to them in a certain way.
Absolutely.
So, well, cool. Thanks for the time. We'll throw up links to Psych Tech, which I highly recommend to anybody who hasn't listened to it. It's a great show. You guys are doing some really, really great content. Kelly, I have to really say the episode, the most recent episode that I just listened to, I don't think that there's been one since. Maybe this week there was, but the one on technology around pregnancy and childcare had me rolling. I was, as you were talking about how parents would be nodding along, I was nodding along and I was laughing my tail off the entire time, because it was, and even just in the 2 years since my son has been born, the stuff you're talking about with the pacifiers closing up, I mean, all that stuff is new since we were buying that stuff. So it's really funny.
We've gotten a lot of feedback on that one.
Yeah. I imagine you would. So I highly recommend that. We'll put links there to the shows. I'm going to try to go out and find, Josue, if you have a good YouTube video, the 360 video that you would recommend, I might include that in the links below too. I'll find at least one, but I'll talk to you once we stop this and find out if you have one that you recommend. Sure. That way that, you know, it'll be convenient for people to find. And then, you know, be sure to check out links to both Josue and Kelly. They're both on Twitter, and their website is very active for their show. Thanks for the time. I very, very, very much appreciate you guys joining me on this. I really like this conversation. I'm excited about what this technology is going to bring to us, both clinically and just personally, you know, just from a geeky gamer, but also from, you know, I'm really excited about the application of all this stuff.
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
Thanks, Michael.
Yeah. All right.